Hello, I'm Peter King, and welcome to the MMQB podcast with Peter King, where I take you inside the minds of the biggest influencers in the NFL. This week, Sam Weich, the former Cincinnati Bengals and Tampa Bay Buccaneers head coach, and just recently, earlier this fall, underwent a heart transplant. I went to South Carolina to talk to Sam Weich, an emotional conversation about his life in football and what an incredible Thanksgiving he expects to have because of his new heart.
Well, it means a lot more than any Thanksgiving I can remember because I, by all rights, I shouldn't be here. The nurses and the doctors said, you know, you were right up to the limit. You probably were over the limit. The nurse said, boy, you pushed this one right to the edge.
Now my conversation in Pickens, South Carolina, with former NFL head coach and new heart transplant recipient, Sam Weich. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once. Watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/MMQB. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MMQB. And one more time, you'll get it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/MMQB. So, the special Thanksgiving podcast here at the MMQB podcast with Peter King. I've journeyed to Pickens, South Carolina, home of a lot of churches and a few gun shops. And I've journeyed to this place about 2 hours from Charlotte to the home of Sam Weich, the former NFL quarterback, the former NFL coach. The coach of the Cincinnati Bengals in 1984 when I was just a rookie on the NFL beat. So I've come here to tell the tale of Sam Weich, who 9 weeks ago had a heart transplant at the age of 71, right?
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. You had a heart transplant. But anyway, we sit here today in Pickens in your man cave. And I'll tell you one thing, this is one heck of a man cave. As we sit here, Sam, describe the dimensions of the room that we are in on your property.
Well, it was designed originally to be 30 by 30, 30 feet by 30 feet, with a covered deck that is also 30 by 30. We're overlooking the Blue Ridge Mountains in one direction, of an 18-acre pasture. We've got 28 acres altogether.
With three horses.
With three horses. One of them that is decommissioned. She's had a lot of foals, a lot of babies, and we sit out there and just enjoy the sun coming up and the sun coming down. It's just a peaceful place to live. Plus, Jane, my wife, is super happy because this is where all of her old boyfriends still live. So, you know, she goes to the post office a lot. I don't understand that.
Well, Sam, in this room, there's a gigantic deer right over your head.
It's an elk, but nice
it's an
try.
Elk. A nice try.
Take
you
a
can
shot.
See, I'm Mr. Wilderness.
You didn't say rabbit, at least. That's good.
Anyway, is that your elk?
It is now because I paid $500 for it. It's a 12-point elk. And it was the ticket on that, by the way, was $5,000. The guy is an avid hunter that in Greenville, South Carolina, that sold it to me for $500 because he shot one that was even bigger than the one you're looking at. And if you look at the size of the neck and the girth on that one, that's a giant animal. So it
where's this elk from?
This one, I believe, is from New Mexico. Wow. And he went and got another one from New Mexico, and it was bigger than this one. But yeah, I'm not a hunter. I could I would probably miss you from here, and we're sitting right across the table from each other. Yeah.
Sam Weitsch, we're going to get to the story. The reason why I came down here is that not only because I've known you for a long time, but because I really felt like your story is such a great story for this time of year, for Thanksgiving, because really, there but for the grace of God go any of us who, you know, you've been a healthy guy, you're not a hard liver, and basically you ended up needing a heart transplant and got one in the nick of time. So we're going to get to that here in a few minutes on the podcast, but I wanted just to, for people who are driving through the woods to grandmother's house for Thanksgiving, and I hope a lot of people are listening to this at this time of year with family, I did just want to tell the football fans a little bit about the mark that you have left on the NFL. And I'll just preface this by saying that in 1984, my rookie year on the beat, one of my first meetings with you, you did something that was absolutely, in today's world, Paul Brown would have fired you. You would have been the laughingstock of all coaches. But I sat in your office at Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati. The draft was going to be the next day. And you basically went down your draft board and you said, hey, listen, you know, just make sure that, you know, you don't tell any of your buddies like in Cleveland or Houston or anywhere what we're doing. In those days, there was no internet. I could write in the Cincinnati Inquirer who the Bengals were going to draft the next day, and no one would know. It was an echo chamber. You know, people in Cincinnati would know.
Yep.
So you told me, yeah, we like this guy Pete Koch in the first round, and we really like this guy Ricky Hundley, this linebacker from Arizona. This was the draft where the Bengals ended up trading the first pick in the draft and got a slew of picks because Steve Young, had he said that he would have played for the Bengals, you know, and not signed with the USFL, you would have drafted Steve Young and you would have been able to coach Steve Young, who would have been a quarterback after your own heart. But anyway, instead, you said, hey, late in the first round, early second, we're going to get this quarterback from Maryland, Boomer Esiason. And then you went down the line. You even told me who your third round pick was going to be, Stanford Jennings. Right. And so we just went over the whole thing, and I wrote it. And so the next day at night, after the draft, my boss looked at me, and he goes, I don't know whether to genuflect or this is a miracle. You predicted the Bengals draft. But anyway, so that I covered the team that year, and it was quite an adventure. And what was different about those days, Sam, is that living at training camp at Wilmington College in Wilmington, Ohio, I had a room down the hall from where your room was, and you said, hey, if you ever have any questions, I'm usually done about 10:15 at night. Just knock on the door if my light's on. And it was really a different time in football, and I must say I kind of miss it.
Well, I miss it too, you know, and I was kind of a preschooler then as a head coach, and I didn't care what the other protocol was with everybody else. I wanted to kind of set my own course, and I'd worked with Bill Walsh. He coached me when I was a player back in 1968. I was a free agent, and he was a quarterback coach, passing coach.
Bill Walsh basically gave you your shot in the NFL,
didn't
he?
Absolutely.
Well, what happened?
Along with the Brown family now. Of course, they had to go along with it. But right in the middle of final exams, and I was working on my MBA at the University of South Carolina, and I was a grunt for a young defensive backfield coach named Lou Holtz. I don't know where he is today. But Lou made a phone call. He knew I still wanted to play. I was only 22 years old. I'd started school when I was 5, not 6. And so I was always a year behind that way. And I went up, I had a good workout, they gave me an $11,000 contract in 1968, no discussion about that either. And that was just the offer, take it or leave it. And I left the Netherland Hilton Hotel where their temporary offices were downtown Cincinnati and called my wife on the phone booth on the corner. They had these little phone booths in those days. And the first thing I said to her is, we are rich. $11,000, of course I didn't have a dime of it until I made the team. But that was the start of it. And then from that, the relationship with Bill grew stronger and stronger. We weren't that far apart in age, actually, at that point. And he was a young coach. And we met years later in Tokyo. I was playing, I actually wasn't playing for, but I was holding extra points and field goals for the St. Louis Cardinals. And we were playing a preseason game against the Chargers, and Bill was an assistant coach with the Chargers. And we coincidentally bumped into each other on an elevator going down for breakfast. Your time's all screwed up, of course, over there because you're coming out of the United States Eastern time zone. But I said, "How you doing? I haven't seen you in a while." We were at one time very close. He said, "Let's go down and have a cup of tea." Well, we go down. About 45 minutes later, I start smiling, much like you're smiling at me right now. And I say, "Bill, we're not having a cup of tea, for God's sakes. You're interviewing me, aren't you, to see if I remember anything about football?" And he said, "Yeah, and if I ever get a head job, I'm going to give you a call to coach the passing game," which he did years later with the San Francisco 49ers when we drafted Joe Montana. And I became a great coach on day one.
You know what I remember about that draft, though? You guys, you liked Phil Simms in that draft.
Well, that was our plan.
Morehead State.
From Morehead State. But we also liked the quarterback from Stanford, Steve Dills.
Right.
And so we were kind of talking about them. And Joe Montana really wasn't on the radar until maybe a week or two before the draft.
Did you work out Joe Montana?
Bill called me and said, "Go run down there and work this guy named James Owens out from UCLA, wide receiver, running back kind of a guy. Thought he might be another Isaac Curtis, actually." And I went down. He said, "Find a quarterback, you know, to throw to him so you can watch everything." Well, Joe was living at the time with his future wife in Manhattan Beach. I said, "Can you come over to UCLA and meet me there at 3:30? They did. Cass was there with her camera like a mom would take a picture of her young child working out for the first time, and all excited about this. And Joe was terrific. I mean, he had a great day. James Owens had a good day, but not a great day. I went back and I said, "Before we take Dills or Simms, let's look at Montana one more time, you and I together." And
what did you do? You went and looked at tape, a lot of film in those days?
No, we went back down to UCLA.
Oh, you did?
And had another
workout. And he worked him out.
Yeah. Now, by the way, everybody on the staff and on the coaching staff and on the scouting staff liked Joe Montana. There wasn't any opposition to taking Joe Montana, but you could only take one, so we had to pick with the one. And so the
Giants kind of did you a favor because the Giants picked Simms high. They took him off the board, so you didn't have to worry about that then.
That's right. But we still had a choice between a guy that understood and had worked under Bill's system at Stanford and could step right in and play. We had Steve DeBerg was already there as a veteran player. But we go back down. We go have the same workout. Joe looks even better than the first time. James Owens didn't quite have as good a workout, although still a good one. And we go back. We didn't have a first-round pick, by the way, because the previous staff had traded it for O.J. Simpson in his latter years.
There's a lot of interesting names in this podcast being thrown around. O.J. Simpson, Joe Montana, Bill Walsh.
I've been lucky to be around some pretty good names. I haven't contributed anything to them, but I actually had played with O.J. My last year in 76 was when Joe Ferguson got hurt. They picked me up halfway through the season, and O.J. was on that team. That's when he had 278 yards on Thanksgiving Day against Detroit.
Wow. You never went out on a double date with O.J., did you?
No, but I tell you what, he was one of the most popular guys on the team. And nobody that was on that team could ever believe he did what he's accused of because, I mean, he'd have the Halloween party at his house. He had the biggest house in Buffalo, by the way, I think. Yeah. One of the biggest, certainly. At Christmas time, all the unions, there's a big union in town, they would have Christmas parties for the children of the union members. And Juice would always come be the main one that they wanted. You know, they'd call up and say, "Can you get OJ and a couple of other Buffalo Bills? We don't care who they are." After that. And I was one of those "I don't care who they are" guys. But he would go around from every table, shake hands with everybody so they got to say they shook hands or took a picture with O.J. Simpson, and then you go to the podium and say a couple of nice things, you know, to him, and say, "You got to excuse myself, I'm going to another get together down the road," and he would do that for the entire week of the Christmas week. I mean, he was that kind of a person, so that's why it's so hard for me to accept.
Stunning, yeah.
He certainly was different than he was in those days.
So let me just get one other thing about Montana. Mm-hmm. Tell me about Montana as a rookie under quarterback coach Sam Weich.
Joe would eat the last syllable off your lip. If you talk too long, he would give you a little kiss. I'm telling you, he would lean in if you were making a coaching point. He would lean in to get make sure he got every word and every nuance to what you were saying. And literally, you'd invade your space. You'd say, back up, after you'd already taken a couple of steps backward. But he was one of those guys, though, if you told him to carry the ball a little bit higher and take the nose of the ball up when you carry it by your ear, the next play, he did that. On the next play after that, he did it again. The next day, he did it again. The next game, he did it again. It just was programmed in, and it was ready to go. That was one unusual thing.
You must have loved coaching him.
I loved coaching him because he was cooperative, and so was Steve DeBerg. Steve's the same way. And Steve actually coached him probably as much as I did. When we got in the locker room, he would clean up everything I said to him. But Joe threw the ball with a nose-up flight of the ball. So the ball always just kind of arrived at the receiver. It wasn't ever heavy coming in. You know, Terry Bradshaw in those days had that nose down, high release, snap of the wrist throw. Joe had a full motion. But the ball would travel easy, and it would just kind of land in your, like a parachute into your arms. And, of course, it was very effective, and he was very quick on decision-making in the game. So he was perfect. I don't know what they taught him at Notre Dame. Obviously nothing, because we had to retrain the guy the whole way through.
All right, Sam, we're going to fast forward now to right before your first game as the coach of the Cincinnati Bengals. Gone through all of training camp, you've got a pretty good team. And a few days before you coach against the Denver Broncos, the rookie beat man for the Cincinnati Inquirer comes up to you and says, "Hey, Sam, we're doing our special section this week for the start of the Bengals season. And I've got a favor to ask you. I've got an idea. You may not want to do it, but I've got an idea. You do magic, right?" And you said, "Yeah." I said, "Do you happen to have a tuxedo and a top hat?" And you said, "Yeah, I do." "How would you feel about dressing in the tuxedo and top hat for a big picture on the front page of our special section?" You said, "Oh, yeah, I'll do it." So we arranged to do that on Tuesday, but I had other plans. My other plan was I was going to go get a rabbit at the Beachmont Mall in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And there was a pet store there. And I went in there and I said, "Could I borrow a rabbit for 2 hours?" And I had to give the guy the only credit card I had in the world. And I had to give him my credit card. And he said, "Hey, if you're not back in 2 hours, that's going to be $85. So I took the rabbit in a cage and I brought it to Spinney Field, the Bengals practice facility. And there you were in your tuxedo. And I pull out this rabbit and I said, "Sam, is it okay? Would you pull this rabbit out of your hat?" And you said, "Of course I would. Fantastic."
You know, I was so easy in those days.
You were so easy. But do you remember doing that?
Oh, absolutely. I remember it because I had rented the tuxedo and the top hat, and if I didn't have it back in 2 hours, it was going to charge me $65 too. But no, I do remember that. And there was a full page on the sports section, or an insert section, I think it was, because it was the start of the NFL season.
You had this sheepish look on your face. You had this sheepish look. And here was this white rabbit coming out of a hat. And this rabbit said, "What have I got myself into?" And it was just, it was the most, I say to people these days, somehow, I just don't think if the Boston Globe goes up to Bill Belichick, ask him, "Hey, Bill, for our special section this year, would you pull a rabbit out of a hat?" I kind of don't think he would do that.
I don't know. You know, Bill might surprise you, but probably wouldn't do it as fast as I did. I was saying yes to everything, I think, trying to establish myself and make friends and have the season go smoothly. You know, that game was lost on virtually the last play of the game. We had a blitz on John Elway, and Reggie Williams had him. And Elway makes a little quick move and rolls out to the left and throws one about 40 yards down. They score. I don't know if it was the last play of the game, but it was their last play of the game. We might have had a couple of snaps after that. So it was a real close game in a battle. That was the start of the season. But, yeah, my worry was that hat going to be returned without any mess in it. And it was. But that was fun. I enjoyed those things. I did them all the way through my career.
Do you remember Christmas of that year? I mean, you had an incredible locker room. You really did. Mm-hmm. Because you had, I mean, there's Boomer, he's a rookie. Kenny Anderson, great guy as the quarterback. Collinsworth is in there. Turk Schonert, Steve Kreider, Crum Rye. You've got a bunch of really, really good. Reggie Williams, great
Wilcox
guy.
Wilcox in there now on TV.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So many good guys on that team. But at Christmas, I'll never forget this. So my wife and I lived in Anderson Township, which is a suburb of Cincinnati, and very close to our house. And I guess it's politically incorrect to call it these. There was an orphanage. Okay. And it was an orphanage of the Catholic Church of Cincinnati. And so I used to go by there sometimes, and I met a few people there, and I got this idea. What if I got a couple of Bengals to come by, you know? And, I mean, games are going on. I forget what day of the week it was. I think it was Monday or Tuesday. But I asked Collinsworth to come by. He dressed as Santa Claus. And then I mentioned it to you, and you came by and did magic for these kids in the middle of an NFL game week. And I just thought that the whole thing, the world has changed so much, but those are the kind of things I really take from that season.
Well, I would do those kind of things all the time. Bob Johnson tells a story, Bob Trumpy, because they tell stories on me all the time, but we went to visit a kid at the hospital, in a hospital room. And I had the idea that I was going to dress up like a woman to just have some fun with it. And my wife had a fall. I remember those days?
You had the
long hair that you could, and you would just put it on. So I borrowed her fall. I went down to the Nearly New shop and bought the biggest dress I could find, the one that would actually fit me, and a big old flowery hat. And we went down, Bob Johnson and I are walking down the hall, and Bob is getting a little sensitive about this, so he lays back behind me. He doesn't want to be walking with me. And as we walk past two doctors, Bob Johnson tells me later the conversation that he overheard them say. One of them said to the other one, "That is the biggest woman I have ever seen in my life." But I went in the elevator coming up, I had the fall. I didn't have the fall on. I just had the hat on, and I was petting the fall like it was a little puppy or something in there. And the elevator was full of people looking around saying, you know, looking up at me because I was dressed like a woman. But anyway, we did things like that all the time. That was fun for us. I encouraged the players to do it. I think the players got as much out of that in so many ways.
This is the MMQB Podcast. QB Podcast.
This is Adrian Wojnarowski of The Vertical. For candid conversations with the biggest names around the NBA, be sure to check out our podcast network, which includes The Vertical Podcast with Woj, The Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick, and The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, all at thevertical.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Movement Watches was founded on the belief that style shouldn't break the bank. Their goal is to change the way consumers think about fashion by offering high-quality, minimalist products at revolutionary prices. We get it. Holiday shopping can be tough. But thanks to Movement Watches, all that gift-giving anxiety can disappear with the press of a button. These watches make the perfect purchase for just about anyone in your life, guy or girl. And remember, they start at only $95. You've heard me talk about Movement Watches, and I'm sure you got yourself one. Now let's finish your holiday shopping and get a Movement Watch for someone on your list. I've got one, and I love it. Movement Watches start at just $95. If you are going to buy a watch at a department store, you're looking to spend at least $400 to $500. You see, Movement figured out that by selling online, they were able to cut out the middleman and retail markup, providing the best possible price. Now, here's the best part. Get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to movementwatches.com/MMQB. That's MVMTwatches.com/MMQB. The watch has a really clean design, and I've been getting compliments ever since I put mine on. Now it's time to step up your watch game. Go to MVMTwatches.com/MMQB. That's movementwatches.com/MMQB. Join the movement. You really made offensive football a lot of fun, because what you did was you basically took the players you had and you said, look, I got Boomer Esiason. He's got UNIVAC for a brain. He remembers everything, and he really is imaginative out there. And I'm going to give him a bunch of different things to do. I'm going to name plays funny things. We talked, there was a play that had a 61 in it, and you ended up calling it Mantle. And Boomer said to you one day, hey, wait a second. It's Roger Maris hit the 61 home runs. And you said, ah, nobody cares about Maris. Everybody knows who Mickey Mantle is, though. So you called it Mantle. But I mean, you really had a good time teaching offensive football, and making your players really kind of love the imagination of it.
Well, I let them come up with those names, too. Maris and Mantle, you know, one of them has an R sound, one of them has an L sound, I'm forgotten.
For
now.
Right and left.
Right, yeah. And left. And when that was a protection scheme, so the line would slide right or left, whichever the Mantle. And they could say 60 or 61, but I had it backwards as to who hit 61 and who hit 60. And I told them, don't worry about it. Nobody will ever pick up on that. But when, I had a play, let's just say we're going to run a sweep, and I'd say, give me a word. And the guys said pirate for some reason, and I said, yeah, well, we're gonna have to call it more than one times in a game, give me another one. So they came up with Popeye and Sailor, which told me what they did on Saturday mornings before they came to practice and watched cartoons. But so Popeye, pirate, and sailor meant sweep. Then you had to give it an R and L sound, Ripper, Liz, Roy and Lou, Romeo, Juliet, whatever, trigger, bullet. It's an R and L sound. That tells you whether you run the sweep to the right or the left. And then the blocking scheme, we had a blocking scheme where the fullback was the lead blocker on the strong safety. Back on strong safety, B-O-S-S, boss. And I said, okay, give me a word for boss. Thinking, of course, they would say Sam. My name never came up, by the way. But they came up with Bruce, for Bruce Springsteen was the boss.
Yeah.
And then we came up with another name, and that was the guy that signed the checks, Paul. So Paul and Bruce were the words. So Boomer would get up there, pirate, trigger, Bruce, pirate, trigger, Bruce. On the next play, he'd say Popeye, River, Paul. Three different words were running the same play, so we could do it. And the players kind of memorized the formations, but Boomer – he could, I don't know how he memorized all the formations because we changed them every week so we didn't have the same look. But he would assist any player that wasn't in the right spot at the right time. He made sure it was totally organized where that ball was coming up. And then we'd yell out a three-digit number. I think that's, we changed it around several times. But like 128, in the middle digit was a snap count. A 128 could have been a pattern number. It could have been anything. Defense couldn't pick up on that, but it was on two.
But you you know, there's one thing that I really would like the listeners to take from this in terms of a football sense. Saying, okay, Sam Weich had a good time. He led the Bengals to the playoffs. You made the Super Bowl. You were in the famous John Candy game where Joe Montana looks at the crowd and says, hey, look, there's John Candy. And then he proceeds to drive a stake through your heart and beat you in the Super Bowl. But the thing I wanted to talk a moment about before we get to your heart transplant is the no huddle offense. When people see the no huddle today, they should think of Sam Weich. You were the one who put the no huddle and made, I mean, other people occasionally would run a no huddle, especially at the end of a half. They'd run a 2-minute offense. You made the no huddle fashionable to run it any time of the game. And the NFL did not like it at all. So I want you to tell me why you put the no huddle in, why you thought the no huddle would work, and then we will talk for a moment about why the NFL didn't like it.
All right. Let's go right to the original first little amoeba of the no huddle. I'm in San Francisco. I'm an assistant coach. We have signed a guy named Ronaldo Skeets Nehemiah, a world-class athlete. I think he held 5 or 6 world records in the sprints and the hurdles at one time all together. And he runs a go pattern one day at practice, and he's coming back, and he's breathing heavy. He's just through his, got his mouth wide open. And, and I said, Skeets, what's the matter, man? I thought you were some kind of world-class athlete. And he says, Coach, I'm breathing heavy because I just ran 60 yards as fast as I can run it. And then he taught me a life lesson and a football lesson. And he said, if you'll give me just a few more seconds, I'll be breathing through my nose again. I don't know if Skeets even or Ronaldo even remembers saying it to me because it was just a throwout comment from him, but it was coach talk to me. You mean if it only takes you 4 or 5 seconds to recover from a 60-yard sprint and you're breathing through your nose again and the defense is over there still huffing and puffing, their fatigue factor has started to kick in. And if we continue to do that or we threaten to do it, the no huddle wasn't really a hurry-up offense. It was just the threat of the hurry-up. And in those days, there was no substitution matchup rule as there is in the NFL today.
In other words, you get back to the line, but you don't go in the huddle. But because you're back at the line, the defense can't substitute.
They can't substitute. And I would tell the players, I'd say, there are four signals of fatigue here. The first one is they're breathing through their mouth. They got their mouth open, they're breathing. The second one is when they put their hands on their hips and their thumbs are forward, like they're just bracing their back. The third one is when they put their hands behind their helmet to open their lungs up so they can get some more air. And the last one is when they're hitting the side of their helmet, like, get me out of here. I don't have enough for another play. You have worn them down. It actually started, though, the year before that I came to Cincinnati at Indiana University. I had to beat Ohio State and Michigan, and Indiana was down. And I figured maybe if my opponent is tired and we're fresh, because we're going to practice at the tempo of a hurry-up, to be ready to do it and recover quickly, then maybe we would have a chance to beat Ohio State or Michigan. We didn't. We didn't come close, but we probably came closer than we would have. And then when I got to Cincinnati, there were a lot of good players there. That team was not that
Isaac
bad.
Isaac Curtis, Chris Collinsworth.
Oh, I mean, Anthony Munoz is good on offensive Munoz. Line. Yeah, Jim McNally is a line coach, probably the guru of line coaches. It was not a stripped down team. They were ready to win, but you had to put it together, and it took a little time for everybody to get to know each other. And we lost the first five games, by the way, and we used the no-huddle offense in and out. We were introducing it to the team as well as to the fans. And I remember Joe Gibbs gave me a call one time at 0-5, and he said, Sam, just wanted you to know that I lost the first five games I coached at the Washington Redskins. If things will work out, just stick with it. Well, we won 8 of the next 11, go 8-8, tie for the division. And because of the tiebreaker rule, Pittsburgh goes and we don't. But we finished strong.
How did the players like it? How did an establishment quarterback like Ken Anderson, classic old-style quarterback, was he fighting it a little bit?
Not in front of me. I don't think anybody fought it in front of me. Now, when they get back in the locker room, it could have been a different story. I think at first it was just kind of unique and it was fun. It was, this was something, a new toy to play with. And then as they got going, and I kept letting them be a part of it, you give me a name for a trap, for example, and they came up with Tommy. I don't know where, Tom and Tommy. So they were coming up with their own names, and then they were remembering what these words meant because they were the ones introducing it. I remember one time, though, this is a sidebar here, but I said, guys, I'm going to give you 10 words here, and I want you to memorize these 10 words. They're very easy because they rhyme. One gun, two shoe, three tree, four door, five hive, six stick, seven heaven, eight gate, nine vine, 10, the big fat hen. And now they're all looking around each other like he has totally lost his mind now. Go get the doctor. But what I did was I said, all right, one gun. If one is going to be a quick hitter, I want you to think in your mind, a big gun is larger than you are. You can barely pick it up, and it's got a nozzle on it. It's about a foot and a half wide in the barrel, and the bullet coming out of that thing is just flying out of there, just like you do a quick hitter. And they never forgot that gun meant quick hitter or whatever the next one. And so we made a story out of each one gun, two shoe, three tree, four door. And
That's the old Jerry Lucas memory thing. Are you aware?
I may have stolen it from him, actually.
Yeah, because he always said, if you need to memorize a number, translate that to an image in your mind.
Yep.
And that's how, when I was a kid and I read that book from Jerry Lucas, I remember every history test I ever had, 1945, World War II, Emlyn Tennell. He was number 45 for the Giants. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting how the human brain can remember things if you tell them, remember 1945. Well, I might forget that, but if I think of something when that happens,
And you can do it in the heat of battle, and you can do it in a 40-second time slot. I mean, it fits. It does. By the way, was I credited in the back of his book? I guess not.
No,
okay,
not at
he
all.
Thought of it
no.
first. Okay, no. Got it.
Because that was 1961. Come on.
Yeah, I was.
You were just a pup.
I was a baby.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was going on all the time. A new idea to run a play. For example, every time we completed the ball for more, it made a gain of 20 yards or more. I said, right to the line of scrimmage, and Boomer, you pick it. You call the play, but get that ball off quick. Don't even let the big old fat defensive lineman get back to the line of scrimmage, and bam, here goes the ball.
Okay, Sam, who was the first team? Was it Seattle or was it Buffalo that started to fake injuries?
Seattle,
Their linemen would just lay down.
Yeah, Joe Nash was the guy, and they had a coach.
The designated hurt E.
Yeah. And they added on, you know, it was a playoff game, actually, is when that first time I remember it being a real factor. And the TV had the picture of the coach on the sideline like he was shooting a pistol. And Joe Nash would look over, their nose tackle for Seattle. And he would look over, and as soon as the guy pulled the trigger and popped the gun back like it fired, he grabbed his knee and went down. And I went over to the official, and I think it was Jerry Seaman, but I'm not 100% sure about that. But the official that was doing the game that day, and I said, come on, let's figure this out. They get hurt, you know, on every third down they're getting hurt. And he said, hey, I'm not a doctor. I can't do it. And I said, well, you just pay attention because you can get your MD tonight with what they're doing. And then the next week, Marv Levy, we were playing the Buffalo Bills, who he had beaten in preseason, and we beat him in the regular season, and they were very good. Jim Kelly was at the top of his game, and it's tough to beat a good team three times. But we were good, too, and we had the home field advantage. And so they, you know, claimed they were going to maybe do the same kind of thing, but it turns out they did not, and that was a good thing for football.
So, Sam, my last football question before we get to the reason why all these people have downloaded this podcast, and I apologize, but the football talk is so fun. You, I think, enraged the league office because you were doing something so different, and they did not want this no huddle because they thought that this materially affected the game and affected outcomes of games, and it was unsportsmanlike. So can you tell me sort of briefly what happened the night before a very big game with the officials and how they attempted to stop you from doing it?
Well, it's the night before the AFC Championship game in 1988 season. I guess it would have been maybe January of 89. But it's the AFC Championship game against the Buffalo Bills. We're in Cincinnati. We had home field advantage. Marv Levy has, I later found out, had made a phone call to then Commissioner Pete Rozelle saying, you know, our plan is to stop the no huddle by faking injuries like Seattle did on third down, only we're going to do it on every down if we have to stop the...
There's nothing in the rule book against the no huddle.
Correct. There's
nothing.
And so the night before the game, the production crew that's doing the game, NBC, I believe it was, are having their production meeting. I won't mention any names for this broadcast just to screw it up for you. But the league sends in a representative along with the referee for the next day, and they tell the broadcasters, want to alert you to the fact so that you can tell your viewers what's going on if there's a flag thrown for unsportsmanlike conduct, because we're not going to allow Sam to run the no huddle tomorrow. And then one of the people in the room said, well, is there a rule against it? And they said their answer was, there will be tomorrow. I checked this out, and apparently that was one of those meetings you don't forget anything about. I mean, you remember everything about it, and you don't forget any way it was said. Then that same person looked down, and there was a representative from the competition committee in the meeting, which was very unusual, by the way. And he was asked if he knew anything about it. He said, you know, the competition committee is supposed to maintain the competitive balance of the game. And that person said, no, I don't know anything about it. But he wouldn't look him in the eye when he said it. His head dropped. Then another person said, well, when are you going to tell Sam the game's tomorrow, for gosh sakes? I mean, are you going to tell him right before the ball game? And the answer was, that's our plan. And I've confirmed that with everybody that was in that room.
And so what happened the next morning?
The next morning, about an hour and 59 minutes, because I had a tape recorder going under the towel that was sitting on the table, the official and the league official and the referee come in, and Mike Brown is down in the room, which was a little unusual, but it's the AFC Championship game, and he was there to wish me well, I guess. And we waited for him, and then they came in and told us that we could not run the no huddle because of the faking of injuries, and the commissioner didn't want to make a farce of the game. And so my answer was, well, this is kind of like a restaurateur having the cops come in at 5:30 and say, you know, you could be robbed between 6 and 8:30 tonight, so you're going to have to close up between those hours while you're out of business. I said, this is the only way we've run our offense for 5 straight years. It's the only way we've run it all year long. We're the number one offense in football this year, by the way. It's the only way we practiced all week long, and now you're telling me an hour and 59 minutes, I checked my watch so I could record it, the time, that we can't run the no huddle. go get the commissioner on the phone. I want to remind him that he is messing with the competitive balance of the game. And I think I threw out at that point or at a later point, there are a lot of bets being placed on this ball game. I don't believe I'd be walking around Manhattan without a lot of bodyguards if that competitive balance has been tampered with. The runner goes out. He comes back within seconds. He didn't really call the commissioner. The commissioner, I'm sure, said, if there's any pushback from Sam, just let him go ahead and run it. No worries. And so they came back in and said, commissioner said, go ahead and run the no huddle. We did. We won the ball game the next day, 21-10, I think it was. And we go to the Super Bowl, and that was the great game against San Francisco where Joe Montana, with 34 seconds, wins the game for the 49ers.
That's an unbelievable story. But as I have said to people over time, whenever your name comes up, I always bring up the no huddle and the fact that today you can watch the best teams in football, the best coaches in football. Everybody has got it in their repertoire. Do you take a little pride when you watch the New England Patriots and Bill Belichick and Josh McDaniels pull out the no huddle in the middle of the second quarter and run it for two series?
Well, yeah, I guess I do. I mean, it's fun to watch. I don't gather a group into the, you know, into everybody come in here, look at this. I don't do that.
Look at what Dad did.
But, you know, I volunteered at the local high school here, Pickens High School, and we ran the no huddle. So high schools, colleges, pros, it's not that hard. It's just another way of changing the tempo of the game. That's all you're doing, because you're not running a hurry up every time, but you are running the threat of the hurry up. And now, of course, the rules have changed. And we had in the league meetings discussed it every year that until the Super Bowl year. And then after we go to the Super Bowl with it, that's when other teams started trying, as all pro teams do. They check out the teams that are big winners and they try to emulate what they did to win.
I should say that that was an abridged version of that story. And a lot of the things that we're talking about, Sam has a memoir coming out this fall, which I guarantee you is going to be worth your time. And we will talk about that on a later podcast and in my column, Monday Morning Quarterback.
You're listening to the MMQB Podcast.
Hi, boys and girls. It's Tony Kornheiser reminding you to subscribe and listen to my daily podcast, where we talk about everything from sports to politics to the impending animal revolution. And remember, you can listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play.
Hey, everybody. The holidays are here. And what's better for a loved one than flowers? The Books Company delivers to all 50 states, and they offer products with next-day and same-day delivery. Books offers free delivery on weekdays when you register at Books.com. Books couldn't be any simpler. Simple ordering with no gimmicks, no hidden fees, and especially no secret additional care and handling fees. Books is farm fresh. What does that mean? Well, it means that their flowers are cut fresh and sourced from sustainable, eco-friendly farms. It also means that your flowers will last longer, so your money goes a longer way. Love farm-to-table food? Well, you'll love farm-to-table flowers, too. Don't forget their happiness guarantee. They stand behind their products and experience. If Books makes a mistake, they'll make up for it. Nothing makes Books happier than having a happy customer. Now, here's the best part. Go to Books.com/Peter, and you'll get $15 off your order of at least $60. That's 25% off. That's Books, BOUQS.com/Peter. You will be glad you did. Sam, I've unfortunately tantalized people long enough with your recent life story. I want you to go to around Labor Day of this year, maybe even before then, how you really started not to feel well, and you knew that something was wrong with you. What was the genesis of your most recent health problem?
All right, I'm going to go back a little bit farther than that. I've been a pilot since 1970, private, had my license in instrument rated, twin engine, pressurized rated. I had a nice airplane. And I was doing a game in Chicago after Walter Payton got a little too ill to do it. Kevin Harlan was the play-by-play guy, and Kevin was my partner during the regular season, so I was the substitute. We flew back to Greenville, South Carolina after the game, landed about 11 o'clock at night. I had chest pains, went to the hospital, and it later was diagnosed as cardiomyopathy. Same thing Randy Travis had, only he had a stroke with his. I didn't have a stroke with mine. So over the years, over about 12 or 13 years, the cardiomyopathy slowly weakened my heart until late August 2016, I was out with my chainsaw cutting down some limbs because of a storm that had come through. And
right outside here in the backyard?
Right outside here in Pickens, South Carolina, yeah, in the backyard. And when I got through with it and then chopped them up in the right length for the fireplace and put the tools away, and I'm walking up to the house. It's only about a 15-yard walk maybe from the separated garage, slight incline. I'm breathing like Skeets Nehemiah was breathing coming after he ran a 60-yard sprint, but I wasn't recovering as fast as he was. And I got in the house, and I sat down, and my wife, Jane, I believe that's her name, said, I think, you know, what's the matter with you? You're not breathing normally. And I acknowledged that. I really believed that something wasn't right. So we go to the cardiologist the next day on a Monday. He sends me to a hospital in Greenville, St. Francis, and the examination there didn't take long before they sent me to the Carolinas Medical Center in Charlotte, which specialized in transplants. And when I got there, they told me later that your heart was in worse shape than we thought. You really didn't have. We said you had 2 to 5 days to find a heart. Maybe you didn't have that much time. This I found out after they had made the transplant. So, in fact, fast forward a little bit here, as I'm being discharged after a successful transplant, the nurse said, boy, you really cut that one close. And I said, what do you mean cut that one close? They told me I had 5 days. She said, you didn't have 5 days. She said, I don't know if you had 2 days, but, you know, you were in bad shape.
And so you end up being in the hospital right after Labor Day, waiting for a heart transplant.
Yeah.
And the one story you told me that was eminently touching was about Jerry Richardson.
Yeah.
So you're in the hospital in Charlotte.
Right.
And what happens?
Yeah, I knew Jerry Richardson was going to come by the first time. I've been notified.
This is the owner of the Carolina Panthers.
The owner of the Carolina Panthers.
The richest men in the South.
It could be also owns Spartan Foods. And when I started a sporting goods business years before, I sold my first set of uniforms to him, softball uniforms that he was sponsoring the team. So we had a little bit of a tie there. And, of course, I knew him from league meetings and so forth. By the way, the first uniform I pulled out to show him, I said, look at this, nice. Hardee's on the front and number 7. And then I turned around on the back and looked. Number 3. We had the wrong number on the front and back. But anyway,
but
Jerry,
Hardee's, he's the one who became the Hardee's.
Right.
King
Spartan
in
Foods
the South.
Owns Hardee's, yeah. And owns a lot of them. But Jerry is a prince of a guy. He pretty much commands the room when he comes in there. He is a.
And Jerry recently also had a heart transplant.
About 4 or 5 years before, had in that hospital at Carolina's Medical Center, had a transplant as well, correct? Well, he comes in, and rather than sitting in that big comfortable chair where your visitors are supposed to sit, he says, move your feet over. I'm going to sit on the bed right here. So I kick my feet over out of the way, and he sits on the edge of the bed, and he tells me, look, these doctors are terrific. They know what they're doing. For them, this is like changing a tire. I really couldn't put that analogy in my brain for very long without getting scared because I didn't know, you know, what kind of mechanics there were. But they said they'll know what to do. Their team will be there. Everyone will have an assignment, and they will do a good job. Your job, Sam, is to make sure that there's no infection and therefore a rejection of the heart after the transplant takes place. The next day, and that was the Panthers were playing their last preseason game on a Thursday night about 3 hours after he left my room. Mm-hmm. And he goes out and beats that big drum before the game. But the next day, unannounced, here comes Jerry Richardson again. And he says, move your feet over. I want to sit on the edge of the bed. And he said, I want to reiterate what I said yesterday because it's very important. And I want to make sure you heard what I said. And he just emphasized infection. You wear that mask. You wear those gloves. You keep your hands sanitized. And you're going to have, you know, a successful transplant when it happens. At that point, we didn't know if I'd get a heart or if, you know, you've got to find one with the right blood type, with the right body size, with the right.
Same area of the country, too, right? You know, how big an area?
500 nautical miles. You got to get it from the donor's body into your body or at least start the operation within 4 hours.
So at this point, it's basically you're this a little bit after Labor Day. You're in the hospital. You know that you don't have a lot of time.
Right.
So I wondered, I mean, what's going through your mind? I mean, are you saying, are you thinking that this might be it if I don't get a heart? I mean, what?
I had moments like that where I would try to say to myself, this is it. You know, I've lived a good life. I've met a lot of interesting people. I've got no regrets. I'm a Christian. I'm saved. Christ died for me, and I know that he's got a spot for me in heaven. I'm not worried about eternity. I'm going to accept whatever happens. And then as Monday through Friday, daily passes, and the doctors come in and say, we don't have a heart today. We don't have a heart today. Friday was the deadline before they could put in a pump called an LVAD pump, which is very limiting in what you do. Basically, all you can do is lay in bed or sit in a chair. So I didn't want to live that way. So I begged them for, let's go the weekend. And they said, okay, but let me just tell you, your window for the pump will probably be closed by Monday. We won't be able to put it in because
you were willing to take that risk.
Yeah, because I didn't want to live with the pump anyway.
Basically, if you didn't put the pump in pretty quick, you had a deadline, and if that deadline passed, you could die.
Right. And I knew that. I'm not sure I fully realized and reanalyzed it. I didn't want to think about it too much. But I knew that I had the weekend to find a heart. And if I didn't find one, that the only alternative was that I would go ahead and pass. Well, Monday comes along. Monday morning, the doctor
comes. How do you feel at that time?
At that time.
Are you just weak?
Well, I've been laying in bed. I had a lot of atrophy. I was losing a lot of weight. I've been like 220, 6'4", 220 for most of my life, playing weight and everything. Between 215 and 220, and I was down to 184 pounds. So I was losing weight. I didn't look good, obviously. My right side of my heart was ineffective. My left side was compensating for it, but it was getting weaker and weaker, and there was literally, as I found out later, maybe hours, not days, that everything was going to shut down, your liver and your kidneys.
What are you doing in the room?
I'm just laying there. I had visitors. I had tons of people from Pickens. You know, I can't tell you how many cards we got, and I had a former football teammate of mine at Furman University. His wife wrote a website entry and Facebook entry every day telling people how I was doing. Peter, between the two, Facebook and my website, we had over 800,000 hits. Wow. 800,000 people tuned in to see what was going on. The next day, hundreds, maybe 1,000 cards. I can't tell you. It was over 800 when we stopped counting the get well, you know, we're praying for you kind of cards. But here's Monday morning, we don't have a heart. Well, then reality really sets in, because his next sentence was, that I'll never forget, is that our plan is that this afternoon, or maybe we'll wait till in the morning, but we're going to send you home and let hospice make you comfortable for whatever time is necessary. Those were the exact words. Make you comfortable for whatever time is necessary. Well, hospice is a terrific outfit, and they are there only for people that are not going to make it and are going to die. So the reality of that came even more stark, and I lost it a few times where you just get emotional. By the way, Jerry Richardson, when he was talking to me, would get almost emotional talking about his experiences. He explained it to me, and so I would know what to expect. But as 5 o'clock approached that same day, Monday, September,
you were going to go home the next morning,
that afternoon or the next morning. They'd already started making plans to arrange to have hospice meet me at my house and take care of me for whatever time was necessary. So this is September 12th, 2016. My boss from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Steve Story, had flown up to be with me for a couple of days. We had a great relationship down there, and I can't tell you how many people came in to see me, how many people from Pickens. There's a church here called Ebenezer Baptist Church. It's a predominantly African-American church, and I'd helped them put together, along with Joe Morgan, who was a baseball player when I was a football player in Cincinnati, rebuild a softball baseball field that was the location of the last segregated elementary school in the state of South Carolina.
Wow.
But now it's there. So a lot of them came by, a lot of just people that I knew. Okay.
Even though we talked a couple of times during that, and you were adamant about your faith helping you.
Yeah.
It's one thing to be a person of faith and say, I know where I'm going, and I have faith. But it's another thing to say, I'm about to die.
Yeah, and it's another step to say, how do I know that I'm going to a better place? And there's a chapter in the Bible. Of course, the Bible is God's word. 1 Corinthians 2:9 says that no eye has seen, no ear has heard, and no mind can conceive what God has prepared for those who follow him, who love him, who follow his teachings. And in other words, our little pea brains aren't big enough to understand the big concept of life and death and what this planet's all about. But God has already, I spoke one time at a church and I quoted that God's plan for your life will never take you to a place that his grace won't protect you. And on the way out of church, a lady came up to me and said, boy, I was so glad to hear you quote that. You know, I just bought one from Hobby Lobby, a framed picture of that quote. I said, oh, good. Well, thank you. I thought I'd hit something nobody had ever heard before. But anyway, that was the afternoon of September 12th.
How's Jane handling everything?
Jane wasn't there that day. That was one day that she stayed home. We have animals here, horses and dogs and cats. And so she was back and forth a 2.5-hour drive. And that day, Steve Story was there from the Buccaneers, and he was my companion that day. But anyway, that afternoon, the same doctor comes in and says, good news, we found a heart. This is about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And here's a little eerie story. At Purcell Marion, where my son is an assistant coach.
High school in Cincinnati.
High school in Cincinnati. And at Moeller High School, another high school, a Catholic high school in Cincinnati, where my grandson Sammy plays ball and wrestles. But after the football practice, both teams on opposite sides of town, independent of each other, not knowing that the other team
on Monday?
On Monday, the 12th, about the time of football's over around 5 o'clock, practice is over around 5 o'clock, both of them asked the team to get together to pray for me. The doctor comes in and says, we found a heart.
When did you find out about that?
After the surgery, because I was out of it for about 2 days after that. They had gone to get the heart that afternoon. I don't know who or how that person passed away. I don't know what he did. I don't know how
old
he is.
You know where he was from?
Don't know where. I don't know if he...
Isn't that an incredible mystery that you wish you could solve?
One day I'll be able to, hopefully, when the surviving family is ready. They're not ready. I've inquired if I could thank them, and they said they're just not ready for that. I'm grateful.
You have any idea how old the person was?
I don't know where he is, how old he is, what he did for a living, what kind of a guy he was, whether he was a husband or a son or a nephew. No, everything
what
is
were
kept private.
What were the doctor's exact words to you when he walked in the room?
To tell me we had a heart?
Yeah.
That's it. Just good news. We have a heart. And then he had to get back and get things going. And at 2:30 that night, this is around 5 o'clock.
So in other words, at 5 o'clock, you find out about it. And at that moment, I would assume the heart is either in transit or being harvested out of this unfortunate person.
Right. So somebody's having a tragedy, and I'm having a chance, maybe a chance at a new life, because we didn't know if the heart was, until you actually get it to me, if it's a good fit. But
I think, you know what a couple of people said to me? I tweeted out that it looks like there's a match to your heart for you, and you were going to get a heart. And a bunch of people tweeted back at me, hey, you know, don't act so happy necessarily. Somebody had to die for this to happen.
Right, right.
And I mean, that is a pretty sobering thought, I bet, to you. You know, you're happy. What if this 32-year-old husband, father died terribly and his family is totally devastated? I mean, so your happiness is somebody else's tragedy. That's a pretty sobering thing.
It is, but if you put it in a little bit different context, if I told you have a chance to save another person's life, to give another person a second chance at life, and all you've got to do is, after you pass, and you're not going to need your heart anymore, you're not going to need your liver, your kidney, your pancreas.
Oh, I'd give it.
You'd give it in a heartbeat. And so, and all you do is go by the DMV and get an insignia put on your driver's license. Doesn't cost a dime. You're not going to pay for the transplant or anything. You've got a chance to save somebody else's life.
You're very bullish on this now, aren't you?
I am. It's a mission of mine to make sure that everyone at least considers it. Some people may say, I'm not going to do that.
I don't want to have my body pulled apart when I die. But
yeah. And some people think, I'm too old. Or infants, newborns, can donate a body. part, a heart, or a part of their body. A 71-year-old man can do the same thing. 81. In fact, the oldest transplant donor was 93 years old when he donated whatever part of the body that was used by somebody else. So it can be done by anyone. But at that moment, I'm saying to myself on a Monday afternoon, oh, thank goodness, thank God that I am still alive now that they found this heart. But there's still no guarantee that it would work, that it would be a perfect fit. It might be something that they find out during the process of the transplant. Or I might not survive the transplant. That is a possibility.
What's the last thing you remember on Monday night going into surgery?
I think.
What time was it?
Well, the surgery started at 2:30, but I think that basically the last thing I remember was him telling me that. I can't remember anything after that because it wasn't long after that they start sticking
prepping
tubes down your throat and up your nose and IVs in your arms and prepping me. I was pretty well prepped anyway. In the event something happened, they could get
the real sad thing, of course, is that you missed the Monday night game.
That was, and your commentary the following day, I mean, gosh sakes, I have a stack of Sports Illustrated, you wouldn't believe. But, no, I don't remember much after that, and my wife tells me that it would tell me, even today, she's reminding me of something that happened that I just don't remember it. But you're sedated.
So when is how long did the surgery last?
4 hours.
4 hours. It seems like that's not very long.
No, but there's a team of doctors in there. I mean, there's a circle all the way around you, and everyone has a job to do, and things move fast, but there's so many things that have to be done.
And the heart comes in, and there's a very limited time. Is that right? How long is there that this heart can be out of a body?
That's also 4 hours. You've got to get it. You can maintain it for 4 hours, but if you don't get it in any sooner than that, then it starts to deteriorate and it is not functional. But that's true with your kidney. The kidney's the one that's transplanted more than any other part
of
your body.
So this heart comes out of somebody, yeah, and who, whatever, maybe gets on an airplane and comes to Charlotte, North Carolina,
right,
and is rushed into your body within 4 hours of that other, right, person dying.
And the first thing I remember when I did come to, after all of that had happened, first they cut your chest right down the middle of your sternum. They get a little buzz saw and they cut it and split your ribs wide open and go get it. But they're not feeling any of this. I had no pain, believe me. No pain, no discomfort, no after the operation pain or anything. The doctors did a great job there. However, when you come back to, you realize, hey, I feel pretty good. You don't feel like you just had an operation. You feel so much better than you did before. The doctor told me going in
that you could breathe.
And I could breathe through my nose. But and also I had something going down my throat, too. They take care of every option. But the doctor told me, he said, you won't feel twice as good or three times. You're going to feel three times as good. Well, I think I feel four times as good. I'm serious. I just have more energy now, and it's because I have a very strong heart by some person that had the foresight to say, I'm going to save another person's life when my time comes, and everybody's time is going to come. Nobody's going to live here forever. So at some point, we're all going to die, and if the last gift you can leave on this earth is that someone else will survive because of your foresight and your willingness to be a part of their life. But then comes a healing time for the donor family. It takes time, average about a year, before they're ready to talk about it or meet the person. They don't know who I am. They don't know what I do for a living, where that heart, went.
What would you say to those people right now?
I don't know. Obviously, thank you. I can't thank you enough. I can't. I want to know as much as I can about the person that had this heart for the first time. And I want to know what kind of a person, what did he like, what was he all about, and just for my own information. I mean, it won't make any difference in terms of how that heart's going to perform. But I've had no problems with mine, and the doctors told me you have not just a good heart, you have a very strong heart. So I'm guessing he is a younger guy. I'm guessing he was probably in good condition, probably a non-smoker, maybe a non-drinker, not a drug guy. All of those things reduce the life of anybody and also the life of the heart.
You're listening to the MMQB podcast.
So football's in full swing. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to find tickets for the games you want to see up close and in person this season. There's nothing like being in the stadium for the biggest plays of the year. And with SeatGeek, it's never been easier to get the seats you want for a great value. With SeatGeek, you always get the best deal on every ticket because SeatGeek price compares for you by searching multiple ticket sites. Prices can vary depending on where you shop, but SeatGeek will always find you the lowest available price. I should know. I've used them many times for baseball tickets. And SeatGeek wants to help you get the most bang for your buck. That's why every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value. You'll immediately see any underpriced seats and be able to find the best deals that fit your budget. Plus, every ticket you buy on SeatGeek is backed by their 100% guarantee, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Now pay attention to this next part. My listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. $20 right in your pocket. And to get it, all you have to do is this. Download the free SeatGeek app and go to the settings tab and click add a promo code. Then enter promo code MMQB. SeatGeek will then send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. It doesn't get any easier. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code MMQB today. With Sam Weich on the MMQB podcast with Peter King. Sam, in our remaining time, it's Thanksgiving week. And, you know, as I listen to the story, you know, it's obviously a really emotional story. But what does this Thanksgiving mean to you?
Well, it means a lot more than any Thanksgiving I can remember because I, by all rights, I'm going to lose it here, Peter. By all rights, I shouldn't be here. I mean, what if this person, however he died, whether it was a car accident or whatever, what if that had not happened? What if he left 10 minutes later and not been in the wrong place at the wrong time and that family's not grieving over whatever it was? I wouldn't be here. The nurses and the doctors said, you know, you were right up to the limit. In fact, if you hadn't been in as good a shape as you were, me, said, you probably were over the limit. You were right there. It was this, the nurse said, boy, you pushed this one right to the edge, or right to the limit. And she really didn't think I had enough time, but the doctors did. The doctors know all the signs. So I, on Thanksgiving, am thanking the doctors. I'm thanking that family that went along with the decision of the donor himself. I'm thanking maybe someone that suggested to the donor, you need to get that little insignia put on your driver's license, so in the event that you die suddenly, somebody else can have your eyes, your tissue. There are a lot of football players that have grafts out of from a person that has left not just organs but tissue.
Cadaver ligaments, yeah.
Absolutely. And but I want to thank everybody. I want to thank God for, you know, whatever that plan was in his grand plan, whatever my role is. He's now handed it to me. It's my job to make sure I don't fall short. And I'm trying now to tell everybody that I know, go to the DMV, or you can go to a website, just registerme.org. That's all it is. And they'll send you the information, and it will go to every registry in every state in the United States. And if you pass away on a vacation somewhere, they can still harvest that organ and save another person's life.
What will Thanksgiving dinner be like for you? What will you say?
I'm going to be thinking about this. Our conversation right now, I'm going to be thinking about what we were talking, what I went through and what everybody around me went through. Remember, I'm not the only one. I'm actually probably having a better time than everybody around me because my wife, my kids, my grandchildren, they're not expected to have a grandfather in a few hours or a few days. And somehow things fell right. I can't believe that I won't relive that more than once.
Sam Weich, Pickens, South Carolina. This has been quite a conversation. I appreciate you sharing so much. And I just hope that on Thanksgiving, you're able to have an appreciation for everybody around you and for the man who gave a heart so that you can live.
I know I will have that appreciation. I just hope that I am able to repay him by making sure that others, because of what he did and the impact it had on me, that I'm able to save some lives through him. Not for me, but through him. I'm a donor, by the way, and have been for years.
Sam Weitsch, thanks for your story. Continued very, very long life.
Thank you, Peter.
This is the MMQB Podcast.
My thanks to Sam Weitsch for his honesty, his emotion, and some incredible stories. It seems a little strange to go into the NFL life right now, coming off of that emotionally charged conversation with Weitsch. But I will move on and talk about one thing entering week 12 of the National Football League season that really interests me. And that is the status of Washington quarterback Kirk Cousins. Now, many of you probably saw in the wake of a very emotional and stirring and decisive Sunday night victory by Washington over Green Bay that quarterback Kirk Cousins was caught on Vine by Comcast Sports Network Mid-Atlantic, basically yelling at the general manager of Washington, Scott McLuhan, a very respected football man, yelling at him, "How do you like me now? How do you like me now?" And when McLuhan went to hug him, it was not exactly a hug that was returned by Kirk Cousins. So obviously everybody is thinking, wow, Cousins must really hate this team or this general manager for him to have been so cold and so angry with his general manager. But I think there's a couple of things to realize. First of all, in the NFL, there are a lot of emotions on the field immediately after games. And sometimes you see them. Most of the time you don't. But that happened immediately after the game. Remember Richard Sherman a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, when after the NFC Championship game, he screamed at Aaron Andrews, the sideline reporter for Fox. And, you know, and everybody said, wow, this guy is crazy. Look at this guy. But what happens on the field right after the game, after you've won, is that true, raw, incredibly emotional feelings come out, because it's hard to come down from an event like that. But I'd just make this point. I do think that Kirk Cousins is unhappy with his team for not negotiating what he would consider a fair long-term contract after a great 2015 season in Washington. But Washington's view was basically, through owner Dan Snyder and GM Scott McLuhan, President Bruce Allen, hey, he's done it one time. I think we need to see some consistency before we're going to give him a very long-term deal. So clearly, as you can see in here, this has been on Kirk Cousins' mind, and he kind of took it out on McLuhan from the looks of it. But I'll just say one other thing about covering the National Football League. I've been doing that for 32 years, and I've always said, how great would it be if they let the media into the locker room immediately after games? Because then we would see the true emotion, the true opinions. People in locker rooms, coaches, players, wouldn't have the time to settle down. We'd be able to see them right away with exactly what they feel. Usually what happens in a locker room is that a coach will come in and speak after about 15 minutes. Then after the coach speaks, you'll troop into the locker room. And so maybe it'll be about 25 minutes before most players are seen by the media after the game. And 25 minutes is a long time to settle down and to gather control of your emotions. So most of what you read, most of what you hear in the interviews you see, with the exception of very under control people, oftentimes most of what you see is fairly homogenized. Not that there's anything wrong with that. You do want to put your best foot forward. You don't want to say things that you'll regret. But I've often thought how different a lot of stories would be over the years if you could talk to a player coming off the field after a game, maybe right on the sidelines as the clock hit zero. imagine all the different emotions you'd see. That's what we saw with Kirk Cousins and Scott McLuhan on Sunday night after an emotional victory. And I think if that had happened 45 minutes after the game, I think most likely you would have seen Kirk Cousins shake hands with Scott McLuhan. McLuhan would have said, "Hey, great game." And Cousins would probably say, "Hey, thanks a lot, Scott. Have a good night." But obviously, "How do you like me now?" came out. And I like that in Cousins. Cousins is a real emotional firebrand type of guy who his teammates really, really like. But I just thought I would tell you, that's what really struck me after week 11, that's something that probably the general public really doesn't know. This cooling off period very often douses some big controversies and some big flames that would come out normally right after games. Thanks to my guest, Sam Weich. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to the other great episodes in the MMQB series, such as my talks with Tony Romo, Ben Roethlisberger, and Steve Smith, who on Sunday just became the latest member of the NFL's 1,000 Catch Club. You can find these on the MMQB.com or on iTunes or anywhere you get your podcast. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Listen to other podcasts in our series as well, with Albert Breer, Gary Gramling, and Andy Benoit. Thanks, too, to the folks at Digital Media for their production work. And, of course, thanks to my sponsors, ZipRecruiter, Books, SeatGeek, and Movement Watches. Please support them the way they support this podcast. And I'll see you next week.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.